back. It's the World Soccer Talk podcast, the only podcast that focuses on watching soccer on TV, online, and apps. In episode 82, we discuss the final viewership numbers for the World Cup final, including how many people watched the entire World Cup in the United States, news about the first Liga MX game in English on FS1, which will debut this weekend, what changes you can expect from NBC Sports Gold's coverage of the Premier League this season, and we have a bunch of letters from you listeners in our mailbag section. My name is Christopher Harris, aka The Gaffer, and I'm joined by my co-host, Kartik Krishnaiah. Kartik, the World Cup is over. It's been a long month. Any standout moments for you, or any interesting observations, kind of in brief?
Yeah, the Fox pregame show for the final. I didn't watch Fox pregame, postgame, or late night shows the entire tournament. And I thought, okay, you know, I've watched Telemundo, scrounged and got BBC and ITV coverage. I've got BN Middle Eastern, North Africa coverage. Let's actually give Fox a chance. I can't even describe in words how bad it was from my perspective. It was patronizing. It was insulting. It was dumbing down of coverage. It was essentially a kindergarten class or one-on-one class about the sport, and it was just terrible.
Yeah, I over the weekend. So for the World Cup final, I watched it in a bar, which was for the very first time in the entire tournament that I watched a game outside of my home office and watched it in a bar. And so, you have the TVs on, you can't hear what they're saying. It's just kind of background noise. So I missed anything pre-game or post-game that they talked about, or any of the commentary, really. But I did, later that night, I did watch, earlier that morning, so I think like 1 o'clock in the morning after coming back from going to see a Major League Soccer game, I switched on TVs, kind of just flipping through in the hotel, and came across World Cup Tonight, which is probably the first time I'd watched it in about 3 weeks after the first week. I mean, the first few nights were horrible. A lot of listeners probably won't get this comparison, but to me, it was just as bad, if not worse, than Soccer Talk Live, which is the show that Kyle Martino did, one of his first kind of TV broadcasts in front of the television for Fox Soccer Channel, probably like at least a decade ago. It was a car crash. But just watching this World Cup Tonight for maybe like 3 or 4 minutes, I was like, this is such a bad TV show. It was absolutely awful. It was so Kate Abdo and Fernando Fiore. So they had, pretty quickly throughout this whole month, had had them co-hosting rather than having Fernando hosting the show. And then it was, I think, Grant Wall, Kobe Jones, and Gus Hiddink. And they were just a lot of inside jokes, they weren't even funny, just joking about, just being silly. I mean, it was almost like a really bad reality TV show.
Wow.
But so the World Cup final itself, I missed it. I missed the coverage and the actual commentary. I mean, the game was fantastic. I watched it in a bar in Orlando off International Drive called Game Changers. And there was probably about 100 to 150 people there. Good game. I mean, everyone was really, really enjoying the game. Everyone cheering, etc. And the moment that the game was over and the trophy was raised, I think every single person left the bar and there was nobody there. And then we had the Major League Soccer game on right afterwards. So even though the MLS numbers are going to be pretty good for that game, the Atlanta-Seattle game, I'm not sure how many people actually watched it.
I have to question the wisdom. I'm going to throw this out here. I got to question the wisdom. I know MLS is driven by the metric of attendance,
right,
and numbers.
Right.
I have to question the wisdom of having an Atlanta game on turf in an indoor facility after the World Cup final. I would have put a Portland game on from Portland. With the atmosphere, with the rain. I know it was 11 a.m. there, right? But I would have done that, or a Kansas City game. Something outdoors, something with a vibrant supporters culture, not kind of an American sportish culture, because I think you're trying to hook soccer fans. I don't think it was, or if you're going to have Seattle, Atlanta, have it from Seattle. Although again, it's 11 a.m. there. I just feel like maybe showing Atlanta might, we might in a few months and think that was a missed opportunity, that they could have shown Kansas City or Kansas City or Portland home match. There were some others, Orlando, where you were Saturday night. The Toronto game could have very easily been the game afterwards, and Orlando has an outdoor atmosphere. Although playing in the afternoon in Orlando outdoors is really difficult in the summer because right. of the heat and humidity. But maybe DC United's Audi Field debut. I mean, there was some fear that may not sell out, but in the run up to the match. But I just think the metric of attendance drives them putting Atlanta on. I think the atmosphere would probably, if the goal was to hook people. Now, the goal was to get the highest possible television rating. Those are the top two markets, Seattle and Atlanta. We know that. But if it was to hook new MLS fans or soccer fans who tuned into the World Cup final to MLS, I would have picked another venue.
Yeah, it's a double thing for MLS. So Major League Soccer, by having these games that follow the World Cup games and the World Cup final, I think the most important thing is really to boost the TV ratings. So at the end of the season, when they look back at the numbers of the average number of viewers for Major League Soccer, those numbers are going to be much, much better than previous years. And it'll show an increase, whatever that increase is going to be. But I think Major League Soccer can use that then as a metric in marketing, in advertising, in PR, et cetera, to say, hey, Major League Soccer is improving. In some ways, it's a false number because, you have 15 million people watching a World Cup final, and you have over a million people that leave the TV sets on, and then those numbers are recorded. And I don't think that's a very accurate number, but it is what it is. I mean, for Major League Soccer, it makes sense to at least try that to boost their numbers. And the second thing is to hook people. I mean, to try to get them to introduce people to Major League Soccer and get them watching it on a weekly basis. And we'll see pretty quickly. I mean, we'll see this weekend's numbers, and we'll talk about it on next week's podcast. Does that have an impact or not? Is that going to actually boost the TV ratings for other games that are on ESPN or FS1 or whatever for Major League Soccer? Atlanta, I don't know. It's impressive to look at for somebody that hasn't watched Major League Soccer before and see those massive crowds. And yes, the artificial pitch is pretty bad. But I agree with you, though, Kartik. I think Sporting Kansas City or Portland or something like that, something more authentic that actually gives you a really better atmosphere, would have been better. But I guess it just didn't work out that way. But I think for Major League Soccer, they'll walk away from this and they'll be smiling. This is a good thing, and we'll see. We'll see in the coming weeks where it goes in terms of the TV ratings.
Yeah, we'll see if they maintain that following that they seem to have developed in post-match World Cup matches. Again, the turf, it's an issue for me, but it's also an issue for other people. A lot of other people mention it, which is why perhaps Seattle and Portland would have been disqualifiers. But again, those are outdoor venues. I think the turf as a problem, as a detriment, is enhanced because of the indoor venue. It just kind of goes hand in hand, indoor and turf. Whereas in Portland, you don't notice it as much, honestly.
Yeah, and also at the Atlanta Stadium, the acoustics. You mean having it kind of in an indoor stadium or a stadium that has a roof that they can use, and then the artificial turf on top of that. So for me, it was. It's been about a year since I've seen a Major League Soccer game in person. I think it was actually last fall I went to a game that was Atlanta against Orlando in Orlando, and got to see Orlando against Toronto FC this past weekend on Saturday night. My impressions, pretty much the same thing as last year. The atmosphere is fantastic, so the crowds, the noise, the fans. I mean, it's a great atmosphere. It's a great place to go to watch a game and really enjoy watching and experiencing the fans cheering and the noise that they create and the wall and the banners and the singing and all of that. So that's something you don't get on television, but that is something that's great. Having said that, I mean, still to this day, I mean, the quality of football is poor, and this is Orlando had so many chances and so many basic opportunities to at least get the shot or header on target and would have completely sky it, way over the bar. I mean, basic stuff that you would see that from any other league that you watch from around the world or any other top league, that those strikers would be capitalizing on that.
These are particularly bad teams, Toronto and Orlando.
I'm just basing it on what I'm seeing. So I'm watching. Yeah. So the Toronto team is actually...
Because I see a lot of good finishing in MLS games I watch on television, honestly, and finishing that wasn't in the league 5 years ago, and finishing as an NASL guy, an USL guy, a guy that's really been tied to the lower divisions in this country, I say, my gosh, our guys at the second division level don't have that touch, don't have that finishing ability, don't have that vision. Now I know why those guys are in MLS and our guys are in USL.
Yeah.
Seriously. So I think it depends. It's random. It depends on
the game. So, again, I'm just basing this on what I saw, which is Orlando against Toronto. And Toronto, I thought, was a better team. It's just that Orlando had a couple of chances and did score from those couple of chances. But they had, like, I don't know, like 10 or 15 other chances that they could have at least put it on target. So to me, I haven't gone to the Portlands or the Atlantas or the NYCFC games, but from what I saw, I was just, again, second time in 12 months, and it was the same thing last year, too. It was just a really poor team. I mean, Orlando's not a good team. And Toronto was better, but didn't win this one. All right, Kartik, what about you? What else have you been up to this past week? That's been all I've been watching on TV.
Yeah, it's just
TV.
Been NPSL for me because of my work with Miami FC, and we had a playoff game Saturday night. At the same time, you were at that Orlando City game, which, again, and the thing about NPSL that's very unusual, which we weren't used to in NASL with Miami FC or with Fort Lauderdale, who I previously worked for, or the league I previously worked for, is that you kind of – It's a massive national playoff tournament. You don't know if you're going to have home games. It depends on other results. So Saturday's home game we knew, but we weren't sure we were going to have that game until a few days earlier against the Jacksonville Armada, old NASL rival. It was a very good game. Miami FC raised their level. Best game they played all season. Then we didn't know if we were going to host a home game on Tuesday because Chattanooga and Atlanta Silverbacks, another former NASL team, Chattanooga, big time team in NPSL, were playing. There was a penalty shootout. Phil D'Amico, the keeper for Chattanooga, was here from the state of Florida. I watched this match after our game was done. He came off his line twice and made two saves, and those were the ref chalked those off. So Atlanta advanced. So then we got another home game on Tuesday against a former NASL rival. Actually, Miami FC was never in the league with them, but a rival of the Fort Lauderdale Strikers on Tuesday. We leave the game Tuesday thinking we're not going to have another home game and come home, watch the stream of Laredo and Little Rock. And Laredo hasn't dropped a point all season. Thought Miami FC was headed to Laredo on Saturday. Lo and behold, Little Rock beats them in the 114th minute or something, 2-1. Now Little Rock is coming here Saturday, so I have another game to broadcast on Saturday and another game to prepare for and work around and everything. So NPSL has consumed me, partly because – and it's also this Tuesday, Saturday, Tuesday, Saturday, Tuesday, Saturday format, which we've been in going back to July 3rd. This will be the sixth or seventh game we played in 18 days. So really – with the World Cup and with this NPSL playoffs, Chris, until Miami FC's out, I've been worn down and planning on taking a break, even if now this wasn't my plan, but even if it spills into the first week or two of the European club seasons, I just need a break from soccer at some point.
So yeah, the Tuesday, Saturday rotation, that sounds like it's a European season. It sounds like it's a championship season where you're playing lots of games in quick succession.
Yeah, and it's worn down the players, and I have to say from a business standpoint, it's worn down the sponsors where they're activating for the Saturday games but not for the Tuesday games. That's potential revenue loss. It's wearing down the vendors. I mean, it's just it is very European that way, and that's something about NPSL that's very different than I always wondered, just being an NASL or USL person, looking at the divisions immediately below us, how do they get 20 games in over 3 months? Thinking, that's odd. How do they get 15 to 20 games in per conference or per team? Now I realize it's because they just go – they play twice a week. And when you don't have a terribly deep squad – Miami FC has a very talented squad, a very – a professional squad that came from NASL, a lot of guys on decent salaries, but decent wages. But – Not deep. They go 16 or 17 deep, which is not enough when you're constantly playing.
So coming up in a minute, we've got some news about NBC Sports Gold as well as Liga MX. So before we go to that, I do want to mention our sponsor, which is SeatGeek. And buying tickets can be complicated and confusing, but there is a better way to buy, and that's with SeatGeek. SeatGeek is the smartest, easiest way to get tickets to every type of live event. Whether you're searching for a last-minute deal, planning a night out with friends, or need to find the perfect gift, SeatGeek helps you find the best seats at the best prices, fully guaranteed. There's nothing quite like being there in person, and SeatGeek will get you closer to the action for a great value. Now, I have the SeatGeek app on my phone, and it's by far the easiest way I've found to shop for tickets. I can be anywhere, and just with a few taps, I can instantly find seats. And I've been using SeatGeek in the past couple of weeks to look for tickets for the International Champions Cup, maybe to take some of my kids to those games. SeatGeek is designed to make your ticket buying experience easier than ever. It saves you time and money by searching multiple ticket sites to compare prices and find amazing deals. And to get the most bang for your buck, SeatGeek grades every ticket based on value to help you immediately identify the best seats that fit your budget. Plus, every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop for tickets on SeatGeek with confidence. Make SeatGeek your go-to app for finding the best deals on every type of ticket, from sports and concerts to comedy and theater. Best of all, my listeners get $20 off their first SeatGeek purchase. Just download the SeatGeek app and enter promo code WSTPOD today. That's one word. That's promo code WSTPOD for $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. Now, Kartik, over to you for some TV streaming news.
Yeah, NBC has announced that the NBC Sports Gold paid subscription service will be returning for the 2018-19 season. So for everyone, the same everything is the same except the addition of a new show called Garrymole Soccer Box and a guarantee of at least four games per club that will be shown exclusively via NBC Sports Gold. That's a jump from 120 to 150 games overall that will be on that. By the way, the price still remains $50 a season. Note, because I've got the notification, your subscription will auto-renew on August 1st if you don't cancel it now or in the next 2 weeks.
Yeah, you go. Yep, absolutely. I've already switched off the auto renew, and for me, I'm not sure if I'm going to renew it though, Carter, because with Swansea going down to the Championship, which actually, so Swansea's, rather than going with iFollow, and this goes for a lot of Championship and League One and League Two clubs, a lot of them are going with their own video streaming service and not using iFollow.
Really?
So Swansea has their own service, they're launching, and I think it's $145 a season. So it's a lot of money. If you work it out per game, maybe it's not so much. But
so I'm surprised the Championship or the Football League is allowing them to opt out of iFollow. That's something worth exploring.
I think even last season, I think Leeds United, Aston Villa, and a few others kind of said, okay, forget iFollow. We're just going to do our own subscription service. And I'm sure they can make more money from it because there's no middleman, which would be the EFL with the iFollow. So, the NBC Sports Gold, I'm not sure if I'm going to renew that. I might. I don't know. I have to wait and see. But, you mentioned the Gary Neville Soccer Box show. That's going to be a new addition. Everything else is the same. It's interesting because I originally wrote the story about the number of games increasing. So, last season, it was 130 that they're advertised. And then this season, this coming season, it's going to be 150. But hearing back from NBC Sports, they said actually the number of games that were streamed last season ended up being 150. It was that with the way that the schedule worked out.
Rescheduling of game matches, there was a lot. There was more last season than in previous years, it felt like.
Yeah, so actually they said that the number of games is the same as what it was last year. It's 150, and it's still $50 a season. I guess at the end of the day, it depends if you're a hardcore fan of Premier League clubs in general, and you just like watching the Premier League, I think it's worth it. Or if you're a fan of the other 14, so you mean the top six, they're not going to be on there that much. They're going to be on there probably a minimum of four, or actually probably a maximum of four games. Each and then all the other 14 clubs, they're probably going to be on there from like 40 to 60% of the time on NBC Sports Gold. But it's interesting that they're bringing that back out. The other thing, too, is they've actually officially now added a service or an option for bars and restaurants. You can go to worldsoccertalk.com for our story about NBC Sports Gold, and then it has a link then to find out more information if you're a bar owner or you're a supporters group and you want to find out, you know, how much it costs or how do I go ahead and find out more information about that service. All right, so the new Liga MX season kicks off this weekend with most of the games on Univision Deportes. The season begins on Friday, while FS1 is going to broadcast their very first English-language broadcast of Liga MX, and that is on Saturday, July 21st at 10 p.m. Eastern. It's Club Tijuana against Chivas. Fox, up until this podcast, which we're recording on Thursday, haven't announced any details, so we don't know who the announcers are going to be. Maybe Jorge Perez Navarro, perhaps. We're not sure. We'll have to wait and see on that one. And also, the game is going to be shown on some Fox Sports regional networks, Fox Sports Arizona, and I think Fox Sports San Diego, and probably some other ones too. So, and also the Spanish language broadcast of this game is going to be on Fox Deportes. So Fox has the rights, English and Spanish, to the home games of Club Tijuana, otherwise known as Cholos.
Are they cannibalizing their own audience, putting matches on Fox Sports regional networks and on FS1? I mean, I guess it all adds up, but that's interesting.
Yeah, it is a bit, right? Yeah, because it's one of those things that I'm sure regionally within Arizona and San Diego, you mean Cholos is probably more popular. So maybe
Cholos is a local team in San Diego for all intents and purposes.
Exactly. So I'm not sure. I don't know. I mean, maybe they're thinking that not all the games will be on FS1 and some of the games will be on the Fox Sports regionals. And maybe but even with the Fox Sports regionals, not all those games are going to be live. So I don't know. Maybe, yeah, I'm sure there's some cannibalization there. But at the end of the day, I don't know. Maybe it all adds up to better ratings for both the regional channels, networks, and FS1 as a bigger sports network.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this. Actually, I'll have the Miami FC game, but I'm going to hit the DVR and make sure I tape that.
Yeah, I'll watch it too. Yeah.
The Club Tijuana is a club I try and follow anyway. So I'm actually, as much as we criticized Fox the last few weeks on this show, I'm actually excited that Fox is broadcasting their home games this year, because I probably will try and watch all of them, if I'm perfectly honest. And there's to those that don't know, that there's a real American flavor to that club, which makes sense. They're right on the border. They get a lot of cross-border fans. But a lot of the U.S. men's national team pool players that you see called in for B friendlies or even the fringe of the A friendlies or the Gold Cup, et cetera, have either passed through that club or currently play for that club. So it's definitely a very kind of Americanized team in Liga MX. Moving on. So over 5 million U.S. consumers will cut the cord in 2018, a move that will cost the pay TV industry billions in lost subscription revenue, according to a survey. Cord cutters saved an average of $85 each month after leaving pay TV, according to survey responses. And of those who left, 79% said they were happy with the decision to cut the cord. Only 5% said they regretted their decision and would go back to pay TV. Those are pretty striking numbers, Chris. The question I have to ask you as a cord cutter in the wake of this news is, now that you have to add an ESPN Plus, a Bleacher Report Live, all of these a la carte OTT services, does that 5% begin to spike up?
Yeah, well, it hasn't started yet. So which is interesting too, because Bleacher Report Live originally was supposed to be free through until the end of June. Then they changed it. So anyway, Bleacher Report Live at some point is going to start charging, probably in the coming weeks, and once we get closer to the Champions League season. So I haven't paid that yet. I think that's part of it. I haven't had to pay it. Once I have to start paying, then it's a different story. But yeah, Bleacher Report Live, NBC Sports Gold, I mean, my Swansea kind of streaming package, DAZN and others, I'm sure it's going to start adding up.
Yeah.
But whether you're a cable, if anything though, Kartik, if I'm a cable subscriber, I'm probably going to be more upset than I would as a cord cutter. At least with cord cutting, I'm saving money and not having to to subscribe to Comcast every month. I don't know. It is going to get more expensive, and that's the thing at the end of the day for everyone, whether you're a cord cutter or whether you're a cable or satellite subscriber. If you want to watch everything you want to watch, it's going to cost you more money. But so we'll have to wait and see on that one. But yeah, it's going to be very, very interesting in the next couple of months. At the end of the day, too, the sad thing is it promotes illegal streaming more. It encourages people to go down that path. But I don't know. We'll probably cover that on an upcoming podcast, I'm sure. All right, moving on to TV ratings. So some big numbers, of course, out of the World Cup. And so the average number of viewers for a World Cup game, so you had 64 games, and taking Fox Sports and Telemundo combined, that average for the World Cup was over 4 million viewers. 2 million of those were from Telemundo, and approximately, I think 2.2 or 2.4 from Fox Sports. So 64 games, that's pretty incredible to have those types of numbers, even for games that, Egypt against Saudi Arabia, games like that where you wouldn't imagine the viewership would be that great. Across the entire World Cup, decent numbers. Of course, they're down from 2014, with the US not being involved. We expected that. But at the end of the day, for the World Cup final, which was on both Fox and Telemundo combined, was 16.2 million viewers, which is fantastic. That one game in isolation. And once you include the streaming numbers with that, so from Fox Sports streaming and Telemundo streaming, that climbs to over 17 million people that watched the World Cup final. What it does not include yet is the out-of-home viewership. So people like myself who went to a bar and, whether it was a public watch party outside, or whether it was like in Miami where they had like a huge giant screen in the bay where people were watching it.
There was a couple of places in Miami, actually. I mean, there was the Wynwood event. There was an event on the Miracle Mile in Coral Gables, and there was an event at the Wharf in Miami. I mean, I have to say, Chris, I guess I shouldn't have – this is maybe the wrong time, but I should have mentioned it earlier. There's nothing quite been in my soccer fandom experience like being in Miami during a World Cup, being in downtown, being in the Brickell area, being in the Central Business District. It was amazing. It was like being in Europe. Wow. It was great. I can't even quite, and this is part of the reason why we record this podcast and I get in the car and run down to my office, because it was just, there was this feeling, people wearing their kits into, and I mean, there's a stereotype in the rest of the country that, oh, it's just Latin American fans. So many people I saw wearing Spain and England kits in particular, but also even some Belgium, even some Germany in Miami, which has become a very kind of European city also in the last 5 to 10 years. There's been a shift in the demographics, which I know Don Garber and David Beckham have highlighted in their presentations about MLS there. But it was amazing. And then you still have that Latin element, a lot of Colombia fans more than anything, fewer Brazil fans, fewer Argentina fans, but Colombia in particular. It was just neat. It was just a lot of fun.
Yeah, and that's the thing, though, too. I mean, I think nationwide, I mean, not in every area, but listeners probably, too, in terms of places that you went, or you mean bars, or just talking to people. I mean, everyone seemed to be in on this World Cup. All my contacts, people I'd run into, everyone was really excited about this World Cup. So it'll be interesting to see what those out-of-home viewership numbers are and what the final tabulation of that viewing audience is for this World Cup final, because... And yeah, I'm sure it's much, much greater than 17 million. 17 million by itself, still, I mean, it's lower than the 2014 World Cup final, which was Germany against Argentina. There you had two powerhouses. I mean, so you had, Germany and Argentina with Messi. Croatia, just a great success story, but a very small population. And then France, which, there's a lot of Americans that hate France. But
no, it's not only that. It's just, I think there's been a decline in sports television ratings since 2014 in general.
Oh, yeah. But I'm just comparing it to, absolutely. Yeah, there's been a trend with that, too. So 2014, it was 26 million that watched the final. Not an apples-to-apples comparison, but just to put it into context. But still, I think 17 million for that final was pretty darn good. The game that followed it was the Atlanta game against Seattle, which was on Fox on Sunday. The viewership, the average viewership for that one was 1.5 million, which puts it in the top five most watched Major League Soccer games, I believe, in the history, or at least in the last 10 years of the league. So it's a huge number there, 1.5 million. Then we had LAFC against Portland. That was on Sunday evening on ESPN. This one had 263,000 viewers. So taking the World Cup effect out of the way, here's what we have with more realistic numbers for Major League Soccer, which is the 263,000 for LAFC Portland, which was a 0-0 draw, I believe. Then you had, just to put that into context, so that 263,000 viewership, that same afternoon on ESPN2, you had the Cornhole Championship, and that one had 236,000 viewers. So, I don't know, you wouldn't expect there to be many fans.
That eating corn? What is that?
Cornhole. That's a game that you have those bags that you have to throw to try to land on the wooden frame, like a board, and try and get it in the hole. So it's a big it's a big game among I don't know, college kids. All right, so that's the TV ratings. Let's move on to listener mailbag. The first one up is from Ed Ryder. He sent this in through email. He says, "If we are mainly a Premier League and U.S. men's national team soccer family, does our new Amazon Prime TV service offer anything worth knowing about?"
Yeah, I guess the Manchester City documentary will come out in August, will come out next month, and that'll be six parts. That'll be on Amazon Prime. And then there are some assorted documentaries on soccer that you can find on Amazon Prime TV. There's also – there are probably more on Netflix, actually. But keep checking, because there are things that come in terms of documentaries and soccer things on Amazon Prime and on Netflix that if you're not looking, you won't know about.
Yeah. Other than the documentaries, though, there isn't anything as far as games or any coverage else otherwise. But yeah, definitely some great documentaries. Netflix has a bunch. I think that the Pelé film is on there, as well as the Juventus one. And there's a lot more.
Class of 92. There's a film on Netflix about the Denmark Euro triumph that I was thinking about during Croatia's run. That there's a documentary on Denmark there on Peter Schmeichel and everybody. There's a lot. There's just a lot of good soccer content on Netflix. You have to look for it, but there's stuff if you search. What Netflix does is they get a lot of the English soccer documentaries. Oh, also on Netflix. This might be interesting to you, is the Salford City documentaries.
Okay. Yeah, which I think I've seen those, I think on BBC or someplace, but they were interesting. I definitely enjoyed those, so I would definitely recommend that.
Yeah, they have all three seasons on Netflix, so or all three seasons. I don't know if it's still ongoing, but the three seasons that have been filmed previously. It's really good. You get a look at Giggs and Scholes and Neville, and it kind of reinforces your stereotypes about each of them, to be honest, and Nicky Butt. Gary and Phil Neville are the hard charging types compared to the Scholes, who's very kind of laid back. Giggs, who's, you know, he takes it as it comes type of thing, and then Nicky Butt, who's got a similar attitude. So it feels like Gary and Phil are the ones really running that club.
Yeah,
if you watch the documentary, at least that was my take.
Yeah, anyway. Yeah, mine too. Next up is Nuke via Twitter, and he says, "I'm fascinated how the Neymar Mbappe relationship will evolve this season. How can one man have this much bad luck, going from the greatest of all time to the next one?" And to me, Kartik, my two cents on this one too is that, to be honest, I've never been a fan of Neymar. I think in many ways he's overrated. I think in many ways that Brazil needs a hero, and he's been put into that position. But his value that clubs are paying, like PSG are paying, is far greater than actually his worth in terms of his talent. And I think we saw in this World Cup too, yes, Neymar did create opportunities and assists, but there were many opportunities in games where he was one-on-one with the keeper, or he had opportunities to actually to make something to on his own to create something, and he failed. And Mbappe is on a different wavelength completely in terms of his speed, agility, technical ability, and just his overall, whether it's sportsmanship or whether it's just his attitude. It's perfect. And to me, he's much more of a model professional footballer than Neymar is.
Yeah, I agree with that. And Neymar had problems with Cavani this past season, who is historically, an underappreciated player both at club and national team level, whether it was at Napoli before PSG or with Uruguay. And I have to say, okay, I'll eat a little humble pie on Neymar. He's better than I thought he'd be, but he's not one of the elite players in the world, in my opinion. When he came to Barcelona in 2013, I infamously made a comment that I have to see this guy in the flesh in Europe. I would still start Pedro over him if I were Barcelona's manager. Now it turns out he's better than Pedro Rodriguez. Okay, I get it. But my point was Pedro had won 2 Euros and a World Cup and 2-3 Champions Leagues by that point. I want to see what this guy can do. Okay, he was better than Pedro. Pedro got shipped out to Chelsea the next year. But I build that team around Mbappe and Cavani. If Cavani's 31, but he is the heart and soul. They had Lavezzi before, who I think was an important player for them, and Ibra also. I just think Neymar he shouldn't overwhelm the PSG project because they've had so many other good players come through there. And if you're going to compare Ibra to Neymar in terms of their relevance as top global footballers for any length of time and someone you can build the squad around, I mean, I would take Ibra over him. So even in this period of PSG hegemony, I don't even think he's the greatest player in this era that they've had.
Next up is CT Blues, and he posted this comment on worldsoccertalk.com. He says, what is John Strong and Stuart Holden going to be doing now that Fox doesn't have the Champions League? Is Fox going to send them to Germany to do Bundesliga matches or from a monitor in Los Angeles? Well, I think part of this, too, is, I mean, we reported in last week's podcast in terms of how Fox Sports lost money on this World Cup. And so, if anything, I think it's going to be more cost-cutting. The likelihood of Fox sending anyone to Europe at this point is even worse than it was before, which is a no. So I think it's essentially just Major League Soccer games. I mean, I think that's – and then, of course, the build-up to next year's Women's World Cup, so any U.S. friendlies or games involving the U.S. Women's National Team, I see them getting more involved in that. But I would think it'd be a pretty light schedule, a lot lighter than what they've done in the past. And for those games that are played in the U.S., yeah, I'm sure they'll be at those games. And for Bundesliga games, it'll be off the monitor. Next up is Yannick Ramke via Twitter, and he says, the impact, this is going back to last week's pod, the impact of media rights deals after next season will be limited for La Liga. Certainly there's interest in getting greater distribution and presentation of its products, such as commentary and shoulder programming, to grow in the United States, but La Liga has already been guaranteed a lump sum until 2024 from MediaPro, which is approximately 900 million euros per year, starting in 2019, and so there's really no benefit from an increase in rights fees. In my opinion, he says, there's too much made of Fox losing money in World Cup 2018. It had to be expected. I think Fox also guaranteed viewership aggressively to advertisers, knowing that make goods for ad slots are likely. Losses and profits should be averaged over the rights period from World Cup 2018 to 2026, including the Women's World Cups. After all, it should be one of the greatest media rights deals ever, thanks to awarding rights by a no-bids contract from FIFA as a make-good for Qatar be moved to the winter for Fox. In my opinion, having average viewership of 8 to 9 million people per game in the group stage of the 2026 World Cup is not impossible if USA gets its act together by then. Regarding Serie A, you need to add DAZN as a dark horse candidate. They have added international soccer as part of their offering in every market they've entered. Dragging out the process for Serie A rights should also benefit DAZN, given that they're still in the process of setting up their U.S. operation in New York City. Lots of positions to be filled, lots of hiring going on. Any thoughts on that, Kartik?
Yeah, on both things. Point well taken on Fox and the duration of the rights deal. However, I think $8 or $9 million is a tad bit ambitious for the group stage, even if it is, even though it will be in the U.S. in 2026. I think that that's they're never going to get to that level. On DAZN as a potential partner for Serie A, or partner for IMG. IMG is going to be sub-licensing the U.S. rights in the next week or two, I understand. That's a great shout. I think that they very much could be a player. They are going to be aggressive in this market with international football rights. You're right, Yannick. I just don't know if the Serie A thing has popped up too quickly for them. That's the only question. But
yeah,
that's a good shout. It very well could happen. I wouldn't bet on it at this point, but I do think they are going to be a player going forward. And La Liga, you mentioned Media Pro. DAZN is a potential watch that potential, since you mentioned the La Liga and Media Pro.
Yeah, so with the Serie A, you're right, Kartik. It is too soon for DAZN, because DAZN, I believe today, announced that they're going to officially launch their streaming service in the U.S. in September. I think it's September 10th. So the season starts in Serie A middle of August. So I think they're going to miss out on that. But yeah, we'll have to wait and see again in the next week or two whether it'll be ESPN or Turner Sports getting those rights. Moving on, Josh Denz sent this in through email. He says, can someone please tell JP Della Camera, now that the World Cup is over, that the football lingo is clean sheet, not shutout? Does this drive anyone else crazy, or is it just me? He says, I love the pod and keep up the great work.
Drives me crazy.
It doesn't drive me crazy, though. I mean, because it's very much American lingo. This is one that came up, Kartik. That one doesn't drive me as crazy as other things. Like, for example, Tony Meola, and I was going to mention this in last week's pod, but I forgot. But Tony Meola, in one of the games that he was commentating, was saying that one of the teams had scored goals from restarts. And I was like, I was going to ask you, I'll ask you now. What does he mean by that?
What's a restart? Does he mean a free kick?
He means a free kick.
Okay, yeah.
And I think it was Uruguay, and I think he was just saying that, yeah, Uruguay in this tournament has scored two goals from restarts. And I'm like, what the heck is restarts?
Unless he's talking about quick restarts.
No. It was a free kick. So he would call free kicks restarts. And that, to me, that pisses me off.
Yeah, so in fairness to JP and Meola, I think that they're probably the terminology that was used in the old NASL days when both came of age. Because Meola was playing incarnate in New Jersey around the time the Cosmos were the big thing at Giant Stadium just down the road, were all these Americanized terms. Now, I just think for the audience now, they should be using the proper terminology. But
right.
Yeah, the shutout does bother me, but I like JP in general. It's just that the terminology is there's times, Chris, where, and I don't think JP and Meola are like this, but there's times that Americans do it on purpose.
Yeah, yeah, which Paul Gardner is one of those, as a writer for South America.
Well, he has a big crux with anything European, so.
Right. Even though he's European. All right, so moving on. Ian O'Neill sent in an email. It was a pretty lengthy email, so I had to truncate it a little bit. But he says, on a recent podcast, Kartik stated, you are in a situation this World Cup where you're taking substandard officials from all over the globe to meet some set of quota, end quote. He says, I agree, for it is only logical that merits should trump national origin. However, later in that same podcast, this logic vanished. You agreed with two arguments in Raquel's email, that one, blue-blooded teams are privileged to the detriment of non-blue-blooded teams, and two, the media do not fairly cover non-blue-blooded teams. I strongly disagree with both of Raquel's arguments. First, he says, blue-blooded teams are objectively better than non-blue-blooded teams. For example, only teams from majority white, or in Brazil's case, plurality white countries have won the World Cup. And essentially, all of the best players from Uruguay, Argentina, and Brazil move to Europe's top leagues because those leagues are better and more profitable. But you don't see an exodus of Europe's best players moving to Uruguay or Brazil or Argentina. in sum, essentially all blue-blooded teams, exceptionally talented, excellent players, play in Europe's top leagues. For example, the 2017 FIFA Best 11 in the world has not a single player who plays outside of Europe. Second, the media, while not perfect, do not poorly cover non-blue-blooded teams. I believe Raquel and you think that the media... Raquel and you think that the media cover non-blue-blooded teams poorly because you conflated two ideas. One, they deserve to be here because they qualified. With two, they deserve to be taken seriously because they qualified. It is perfectly reasonable to ignore or barely cover certain teams such as Saudi Arabia, Tunisia, Panama, Morocco, Australia, or Iran. These six teams do nothing more than get the total number of teams up to 32, and there can be no doubt that these six teams are simply irrelevant also-rans. They lack quality and class. Tunisia's manager, after being eliminated, said, "Arab associations need two more generations to reach the top level of performance. Arab associations are far from the required level. Two generations is a very, very long time." Any thoughts on this one, Kartik? Because this was kind of aimed at you.
Yeah. I don't know if Ian's American or not, but the United States is a majority white. It's a white country, majority Christian country, vast majority Christian country. They're not going to win the World Cup anytime soon. So the United States getting American fans jump up and down when European media doesn't take them seriously going into a World Cup. They deserve to be treated just like Saudi Arabia, Tunisia, Iran. Iran had 4 points, by the way, in this World Cup, and were arguably a bad call, which is what Raquel's email was about to begin with, a bad call away
from being a group
with Spain and Spain and Portugal in it. So my complaint is more about Americans who think that Americans should be taken seriously. The United States should be taken seriously in the men's game. We're talking about the men's game, not the women's game. But yet somehow Saudi Arabia qualifying as a joke, somehow Australia qualifying as a joke. And let me point out that these teams all finished ahead of Australia beat head-to-head a team that finished ahead of the United States in qualifying. And Saudi Arabia finished ahead of Australia in qualifying, qualified automatically. My complaint, and maybe I didn't nuance it properly, is with the American announcer, the American media, the American fan, who make assumptions. They have a sense of entitlement born out of some degree of insecurity that they're not taken seriously in this sport, that they're not given recognition, that the English press never talks up the United States before World Cups, although in fairness, the U.S. finished ahead of England in the last two World Cups. If you just go by the FIFA retroactive, you know, they do retrospective rankings after the each tournament of 1 through 32. The U.S. has finished ahead of England in 10 and 14 based on that. But I get some of what you're saying, Ian. I agree with a lot of your points, actually. But I think part of my anger was about Americans and the way that – and part of this disrespect towards Tunisia and Saudi Arabia and Iran was – in the first couple days of the tournament, the U.S. is better than these teams. Really? The U.S. is a team that, given this tactics of this World Cup with high-pressing sides and having to quickly move the ball, the U.S. is a team that I think probably would have fared as poorly as Panama did, if I'm being perfectly objective about it. Maybe they went to lost 6-1 to England, they would have lost 4-1. Maybe they went to lost 5, whatever they lost, 4-0 to Belgium, it would have been 3-0. But they... they're a team that tactically couldn't have hacked it. And I don't think those sides that American fans decided to pick on and say shouldn't be in the World Cup and didn't want to give any coverage to were any worse than the U.S. That's the bottom line. And I think that part of this is the mentality of American supporters that somehow they've been robbed. And there's always this kind of not robbed, but there's this insecurity and paranoia about the European media, paranoia about these smaller countries. You know, you talk about Japan. Anytime I talk about Japan on social media, Ian, and you might appreciate this, there's this insecurity for fans. Oh, well, we've won more than them. We win more continental titles than they do. Well, yeah, you always host the continental championship in the U.S.
Right.
It's American fans. So if I came across this, I was criticizing the European press or the European media. No, because the true reality is these World Cups are all won by majority white, majority Christian nations. It's the bottom line.
I'm not sure if you saw yesterday's tweet from Stuart Holden, which is probably a perfect example of this, which he later deleted, which was essentially saying that look at this U.S. team and don't forget that this the same U.S. team tied France 1-1 in a friendly right before before the World Cup.
This is it. So you will talk to U.S. fans who will still say, oh, well, we beat Germany in a friendly in Hamburg or Cologne, wherever that match was. I think it was Cologne in 2015. We beat Italy in a friendly in Bologna the year that they went to the Euro finals. But you weren't at the same level. You then go into competitive matches and can't perform at that level, and you're playing a friendly. In fact, in that match, Prandelli had called in, I think, a Serie A B player or two to play against the U.S. So there are all of these, and it's all out of insecurity, Chris. I keep going back to this. It's the media, it's the fans, and it's people around U.S. soccer. I don't know. This is like the most consistent theme of this show since we've been doing it, is that there is this paranoia and insecurity which leads to this absolutely mind-numbing analysis, which is condescending towards other nations that are trying to develop a football culture, whether they be in the Arab world or like Tunisia and Saudi Arabia, or whether they be in the Pacific Rim like Japan and South Korea, or whether they be in South America and not and be someone other than Uruguay, Brazil, other than the Southern Cone countries, Uruguay, Brazil, and Argentina. And then there is this absolute mindlessness of trying to say that these other European countries outside of the big powerhouse countries, the five European countries who have won the World Cup plus probably Portugal. Excuse me, because we'll always hear about how the U.S. beat Portugal in two World Cups. So outside of like the very elite countries, you hear about how the U.S. is comparable to them. Even from some people during this World Cup telling me, well, if the U.S. had been in X UEFA qualifying group, they probably would have qualified. Are you kidding me?
Was that Bruce Arena that said that?
Well, no, it wasn't Bruce Arena. There have been fans who told me, oh, well, if they were in... Oh, yeah, but Arena probably would say that.
Oh, he did.
If they'd been in the group which Ireland and Wales was in, I'm like, are you thinking they really would have finished ahead of the Republic of Ireland and made a playoff? Right. And do you think they would have beaten Denmark in that playoff? Please.
And that's the thing, though, too. I mean, friendlies, I mean, are meaningless in terms of the results. So one example, just one example, is that Croatia played Peru in Miami. I think in May, so several weeks before. And Peru completely outplayed Croatia. I think the final score was Peru had two goals, Croatia had nil. It could have been a lot worse. But you can't go by friendlies. I mean, friendlies are – sometimes it's a, it's the coach just trying out different tactics, trying out
I'll
different things.
I'll tell you
things.
Something about that friendly. I mean, because, again, American fans tend to overreact to friendlies. The next day at work – or the next Monday at work, it was a Friday night, I was being chided by people saying, oh, you said Croatia had all these good players, and they're so good. I saw them in person. They're terrible. It was a friendly. And it was a friendly that they had to fly out, you know, in the middle of a European club season too. These games are largely meaningless, and you can't look at the results of them. And it's become an American thing to emphasize. I mean, I'll go back to this comment by John Harkes 10 years ago. 10 summers ago when the U.S. played Argentina in a friendly, and Freddie Adu, he was angry because Freddie Adu didn't go to the corner to try and preserve a 0-0 draw and was trying to put a shot on target. Because the U.S. U.S. needs to get a draw. And I think he was either paired with JP Della Camera or Adrian Healy. I can't remember. And whoever he was paired with kind of, you know, put him in his place when he said this, which I think was Della Camera. So to the person who just bashed Della Camera, I'm praising Della Camera here, but that's been the mentality in U.S. soccer. Let's get a result against a big team, and then let's build it up. And let's say we've done this and we've done that, and then 5 years from now, when things aren't going well, we'll pull out this result because there are still people who say, "Oh, how can you say that we're in decline? We've beaten Germany twice in the last 5 years. Well, they were both friendlies." Right. One game in which Germany had guys like Sidney Sam playing and Dennis Ologo and had a young Ter Stegen make an absolute howler in goal to give the U.S. the win.
Yeah, definitely good points, Kartik. Speaking of the U.S., we've got one more question from one of the listeners, and this is from Craig Shapiro via Twitter. He says, what the hell is going on with the U.S. Open Cup? It's the quarterfinals, and I can't even find it on any streaming service. ESPN could get it for $2. What gives? Also, why doesn't USSF promote this? It's a great way to grow interest in the game.
This yearly question. I wish I had the answers. You're right, Craig. You're absolutely right. But it's not – I don't know. I don't get it. there are people saying that U.S. soccer tries to self-sabotage this cup. I don't believe that because I think they have tried incrementally to grow the digital presence and the stories and having PR interns and such do kind of compelling human interest stories, which there are a ton around the U.S. Open Cup. But in terms of the media rights, other than when FC Cincinnati made their run last year and ESPN picked up those broadcasts, they haven't pushed it. I think if the Louisville games this year had been on ESPN, that might have driven or on anyone, FS1, any kind of media partner, it might have driven some interest. I don't know. Particularly during the summer when there's a absence of programming on these networks, you would think it would be an outstanding thing to promote. And I could just tell you this. Maybe my view is skewed because I've worked around NASL and USL clubs and now NPSL clubs, but the Open Cup is more important in many ways than your league. Now, coaches will always say the right things and say, oh, you know, we want to win our league first. You hear that in Europe also, even when people are talking about, oh, do you want to win the Champions League or do you want to win the Premier League or win the Bundesliga or whatever, or our domestic league comes first. I will tell you from a front office standpoint, the U.S. Open Cup is more important to lower division teams in the U.S. than the league is, other than once you get eliminated from the Open Cup, obviously you focus on the league. But during the time when you've got the overlap of matches, the Open Cup is more important. So we don't see similar emphasis from TV networks.
So going back to Craig, so one of the answer to his question is most of those games are on ussoccer.com and streamed through there. And U.S. Soccer doesn't do a good job of actually promoting that.
Yeah, but my point was going to be that USL games are all on ESPN+. There's some games on ESPN2 or on ESPNU. Even if you had that kind of coverage for the Open Cup, it would increase the popularity. Because as I'm saying, for USL clubs, people can argue with this if they want to, and we can have a discussion about it. For USL clubs internally in their front offices, when they're an Open Cup, like Louisville last night, the Open Cup is more important than the league, period. But yet the league games are accessible on television or on streaming, and the Open Cup games you have to search for. So yeah. That's a problem.
Well, yeah, which is a perfect example, because Wednesday night it was Cincinnati against Charlotte on ESPN2, which I didn't hear anything about until somebody tweeted me about it. And the same night, too, there were several U.S. Open Cup games on, and none of them were on television.
Involving USL teams, probably, yeah.
For me, Carter, it probably goes back to who owns the U.S. Open Cup in terms of is it a sum property? Because it doesn't seem to be. No. And if it was a sum property, then I could see, U.S. Soccer and some working together to try to promote this. But in many ways, though, too, probably you really need Major League Soccer to kind of drive this in order for it to happen.
One property U.S. Soccer tries to sell on their own without some, and they're having and have an actual media rights division or a media marketing division within, or even a media rights person within their paid staff. Some of it is that, so that's internal, and maybe we should cut them some slack because they don't have any other properties to sell. You don't hire a person to a full-time job just to sell this property. But at the same time, it kind of shows their lack of interest in the property, maybe, to a certain extent.
Yeah, that's
definitely... By the way, Chris, this is a discussion that goes on. Craig's the first one to write into the podcast about this. This is a discussion that goes on every single year over and over again. So I'm used to the question. I don't want to sound like I'm annoyed by it because I'm definitely not. I'm used to talking about it. It's just something we've talked through so many times and there's no answer. I agree with Craig. It's very frustrating. Mm-hmm.
So if you have any questions, feedback, advice, or you want advice, or you want to give advice too, you can always reach us via email through web@worldsoccertalk.com, as well as facebook.com/worldsoccertalk, and on Twitter @worldsoccertalk. Plus, of course, you can always post comments on worldsoccertalk.com. So Kartik, before we go, where can listeners find you on the internet or on Twitter so they can catch up on your latest rants and raves?
Yeah, KKFLA737. Look for me on World Soccer Talk. Also, I had just a little shameless plug here, a long primer on the Miami Freedom Park debate and Jorge Mas and Miami MLS on yanksarecoming.com. I tried to balance that article. I've gotten some good feedback on it. So yanksarecoming.com for that. And as that goes to the November ballot, I'll have some follow-ups for World Soccer Talk. So check that out at worldsoccertalk.com in the not-so-distant future.
Yep, and you can always reach me at World Soccer Talk on Twitter or in the comments section at worldsoccertalk.com. Thank you for listening. You can get a new episode of the World Soccer Talk podcast every Thursday. Every episode is released on SoundCloud, YouTube, Stitcher, iTunes, TuneIn, Audio Boom, and worldsoccertalk.com. And if you like the show, share it with your friends on social media and give us a review. And Kartik, with the World Cup over, International Champions Cup getting ready to start on Friday, as well as, of course, Liga MX and the Major League Soccer season, USL. Lots of soccer going on. What should they do?
Enjoy your football.